And if you want a steady income, it doesn't work out.
No.
Well, at the LSE...
How did you go there?
How did I go there? I got a scholarship.
Why did you apply there as opposed to...
Because the people at Latimer said, you're cut out to be a politician. You're obviously interested in politics, you know more about politics. The only place to go, and you've got to go to a university, is London School of Economics, which I'd never heard of. But I then found out that one of the masters was taking an external degree at the LSE. So I said, okay, fine. And this is when you have to sit an exam, and a few scholarship exams as well. I did, and it worked out. I went there, Latimer, to the LSE, and it was very pleasant. I found a few friends, very close friends. I began to play for the second football team, which made me okay with the heavies. And meanwhile, I kept in as part of this small group.
Well, I mean, was it, what sort of departmental structure did it have? Is it the same as it is now?
No, it was dominated in those days by two things. I think if one wanted to say what was distinctive about the LSE in those days was, first of all, the teachers. You know, you didn't go along to someone called Mr. Jones or Mr. Brown or Professor Brown or Professor Jones. You were taught by Harold Lasky or by Professor Tawney, or if you were very lucky, Sir William Beveridge. You know, world figures. I mean, if you were interested in politics, they were world figures. You know, little upstarts who were just beginning their careers as teachers turned out to be Kingsley Martin, the later editor of The New Statesman. You know, they were all stars, and they were brilliant teachers. And Lasky's relationship with his students, and it was a big place even in those days, Lasky's relationship with his students was that he would say to about a dozen, 15, 20 of them, every Tuesday I will arrange to be at home in Addison Place. Any of you who care to come round are welcome. And usually a dozen of us turned up, sat on the floor. He would talk about the American Constitution, about the American Supreme Court, about what the Labour Party ought to do. You know, we would take part as, not quite as equals, because we weren't, obviously, we weren't equals, but as participants, and not simply as people listening and taking notes.
Right.
And that's the sort of place it was. All of them, the history department, the geography department, they were world figures. In the political world, anyway. And the other distinctive thing about it was that there was a very high proportion in the graduate school, anyway, of Americans, bright Americans, would have heard, even in the backwoods of Oregon, they would have heard about the London School of Economics and their ambition was to go on for the LSE. And that was very stimulating, because some of them were very bright. And even when they weren't bright, they were interesting.
So, I mean, who, and you know, who were your friends and what were you reading? What was the...
Well, I was supposed to be reading Descriptive and Analytical Economics. And this meant that you took a history of the theory of economics from Adam Smith through Ricardo right on to the Cambridge economists. And we all loved listening to Dalton on the Cambridge economists, because he was a Cambridge man himself originally. And he could never mention Pigou or Robertson or Marshall or any of the outstanding Cambridge economists without making a joke about how ridiculous they were and how out of touch they were in this ivory tower they had built for themselves in Cambridge. I know when he was told that someone had changed a poster, there was a poster up saying there was going to be a public lecture by someone called Cox, Cambridge economist, who was going to lecture on population. And someone had gone down and transposed the C and the P. And he thought that was real funny. So did I, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And the sort of little circle, I suppose the two that I saw most of to begin with was a man called Bill Sweet, who was reading geography and came from Southend, and a man called, and he went on to teach at one of the polytechnics in the West, Plymouth or Portsmouth, I'm not sure which. And a man called Alan Dudley, who came from Worcestershire, and he, after a few short jumps, went on to become an ambassador. And we saw a good deal of each other first year or two, a little less after that, because the circle widened a little to include Krishnamenon, the Indian communist leader, who was a very forceful figure, and the other man was Abba Lerner, who came from the East End, London, rather late in life. He'd been a presser in a tailor shop, and then someone had said, look, you're too smart for this. Why don't you get some sort of grant to go to the London School of Economics? He did, and became an outstanding professor in the United States, professor of economics. Those two were added to the group, but the outstanding addition was a man called Otto Bechelbach van der Sprenkel, who was the offspring of a Dutch father and a Malaysian woman. And sometimes you look at him and think, well, it's more of his mother's looks about him than his father's. But he and I became great friends. We used to go on holidays together. And he was always inventing ways of spending one's time doing non-work. I remember in my first graduate year after I'd graduated, Otto said, did you know that term is going to start without Dalton's great inaugural lecture, opening lecture to freshers? So how long is he going to be away? He's going to be away a whole week, so they've postponed the lecture. The freshers will just have to start life without him. And Otto said, if it's going to be a whole week and then he'll turn up on the Monday and give his lecture, none of the students will recognize him, will they? He won't know.
Mm.
No. But he'll be introduced. And Otto said, wouldn't it be funny if Dalton were kidnapped and one of us took his place on the platform? And I said, that'd be a terrific idea. Otto said, I'm glad you agree. You'll do it.
Oh, no.
Oh, I thought, oh, God, why didn't I keep my mouth shut? Well, I knew I couldn't back out. I said, yes, yeah, sure, I'll do it. But somehow you've got to arrange for me to get a gown. Simulate Dalton. Well, fortunately, I had heard the lecture three times, so I knew all his jokes. They stole Professor Ginsburg's down, because he was the shortest man on the staff, and therefore it more or less fitted me. And by the time I reached the theatre where the lecture was to be given, the word had spread. Every member of the staff was there, including Beveridge. Mm-hmm. Every one of the porters was there. Every one of the attendants at the lavatory was there. I thought, oh God, what am I doing? What have I done? I thought, whatever. Otto said, I've got to do it, so I better do it. I walked to the platform, stood up, and welcomed them. Hoped they would have a fruitful, successful time, followed by an equally fruitful, successful career. And then I gave them the first of Dalton's standard jokes. It was a mild smile and a little titter. I went on a bit about books they should read, and then I came to the second of Dalton's jokes. It's got a better reception. I went on a little longer and produced the third of his standard jokes. This was at the expense of the Cambridge Economist. That puzzled some of the students, but they laughed by now. And at that point, I looked up and Bill Sweet was standing at the back of the hall doing this. Apparently what had happened was that Dalton had turned up, they had gone to his room, and they had arranged a relay of obstacles.
Yeah.
As he was getting ready to go to give the lecture, someone had stopped him and said, oh, Professor Dalton, I'm so glad that you, Dr. Dalton, I have a terrible problem, you must help me with this. It'll only take 2 or 3 minutes, and Dalton said, all right, come on in. So that had given me another 3 or 4 minutes. And then he came out as he got to the top of the stairs. Another student was talking about but this couldn't go on for long. By the time the third student tried it, told him, I'm sorry, I'm already late. Come see me tomorrow. So when Wolf Sweetness, I said, oh, now I'm afraid I've got to stop my lecture there. I have rather an urgent appointment that I'd forgotten all about. I'll see you all tomorrow. And there was a window at the back of the theatre, and I hopped out of the window.
Through the window?
And the students were completely flabbergasted. And at that point, Dalton walked in. Walked in. Still in amazement, except from the faculty, who were already enjoying the thing. And he got up on the platform and welcomed them all, wished them happy, successful career, and then gave them his first joke, which they already knew. There was a roar of laughter. Well, it's gone down well this year. And the second joke, they didn't let him finish. They gave the punchline themselves.
He must have been so confused. Did you observe? You waited to observe it?
No, Bill Sweet said there. I was, couldn't get out of the well I jumped into without help. And I went home afterwards. They told me it had been a great success. They returned Ginsberg's gown to his room. I went home and I thought, well, now I ought to register at the employment exchange and get myself a job and do something, but I go to school first anyway, collect the books and football boots that I left there in the locker. And the minute I opened the door, the LSE to walk in, the boy said, hey. And I said, yeah, what is it? He said, I've got a letter for you from Dr. Dalton. I said, oh, well, have you? He said, yes. He said, I was to give it to you as soon as you arrived. Well, all right. I took it down to the lavatories and I opened the letter. It's a sheet of paper on which had been written, congratulations, Hugh Dalton. Wasn't that marvellous of him?
Yes, he was really relieved as well.
Oh, God, I know. And when he came to write his autobiography, he mentions this incident. And he said, I am convinced that Mark Abrams will go far. So that was Otto. And again, Otto took me off to Salzburg. Mm. It was an absolutely marvellous experience for me. We didn't see much of world-level opera in Edmonton.
No.
Going to Salzburg was quite a thing, but Otto had an obsession with toy soldiers. So as we left Salzburg to go north, he began spending his money on lead tin toy soldiers. And when he'd spent all his money, he said to me, "Mark, how much money have you got left?" And I parted with it, you know, until I had no money left. And he said, "Well, don't worry. In Amsterdam, I've got an uncle. And he's rich. All I've got to do is knock on the door, and your purse is full, my purse is full. We will live again." So I said, "Okay." And so we got to the railway station at Amsterdam, and Otto called up a taxi, gave the taxi driver his uncle's address. Off we went. Otto said to the taxi driver, of course he could speak Dutch, "Well, wait while we get
someone to pay over the door."
With the money. We knocked and we knocked and we knocked. And then finally someone from next door said, "Who is it you want?" And Otto told him. He said, "Oh, your uncle is away in Switzerland on a holiday. There's no one there." Well, fortunately, Otto was able to get enough money from her to pay the taxi driver. And we went walking till the morning. And then in the morning we went to Uncle's office and explained our position to the finance officer. He said, "I've got no authority to give you money to go anywhere. The most I can do is I can give you money for food and money to spend the night, cheap place, and that's as much as far as I can go. And possibly your uncle will be back tomorrow, the day after, and have to clarify matters, and he'll perhaps advance you money to get back to England." Okay. The next day, same thing happened. Uncle's still back. And Otto said, "All right, well, you know, we just walk around." So we went to a place. We passed a place. Otto said, "Let's go in and have a drink." I said, "You're crazy. We've got no money for a drink." He said, "Oh, don't be silly. Come on in." We went in and had beers. And Otto finished his. And says, "Now, Mark, I want you to go and stand at the door and hold the door open while I explain to the bartender that we've got no money, but make sure the door is open." So Otto went to the bartender, and before the bartender could jump over the counter, Otto was out of the open door and I was with him, and we ran and ran and ran until we were sure that no one could catch up with us. The next day we went to Uncle's office. It's not worth it.
Maybe it's just a little stuff. Okay, can you just talk a little bit?
Yes, I think the weather is greatly improved.
Now, well, you and Otto were caught up in...
Well, on the third day...
Now, where were we? You and Otto were stuck in...
Well, on the third day...
Yeah.
On the third day, we turned up at Uncle's office, and the finance officer said, "Stop. I've bought you two aeroplane tickets to take you back to London. If you get a bus straight away, it'll take you to the airport, and you can be back in London in 2 hours' time." We said, "What about sandwiches?" He said, "I've bought some sandwiches for you. Here they are." But that was Otto.
He sounds like a pretty young, wicked character. I mean, did he end up in prison or something?
No, he ended up as a professor of political philosophy in Australia.
Oh, well, that's where they always send that sort of person.
That's right.
Criminals and vagabonds.
But anyway, after that, I needed a job, having got my PhD. Tawney was my supervisor. Mm-hmm.
What was your PhD on?
Oh, God. It was on the origins of the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it dealt with the royal monopolies granted in the beginning of the 17th century to courtiers, some of whom simply made a lot of money and wasted it, spent it on women and so on, and some of whom regarded it as a possible nest egg to invest in what was going to become the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
And that's what I...